This week on Required Reading, we finish out season three with a modern classic, I guess? At least a modern book that warranted a lot of discussion. We talked Fight Club by Chuck Palahniuk, and thanks for listening to season three. Listen all the way to the end, and we'll give you some information about Mike Carroll's short story and book coming out. Well, at least news about it. And keep listening, keep letting us know what you think, and keep updating us and sharing and doing all those things that keep making us want to do this show. During the summer, we keep promising a release a month, and thanks.
There's no way I can start this podcast with a Fight Club joke, is there? They've all been done to death. Welcome to Required Reading. This week we read Fight Club by Chuck Palahniuk.
Palahniuk, yeah, the name has always escaped me. I've always pronounced it Palahniuk, but I'm probably wrong on that.
Yeah, no disrespect. We picked this book because I read it in high school, and the gentleman around the table, one, it's his first time. Had you read this before?
I had, yeah. I also read it for high school.
Yeah. As I said, I think I'm the only white male in America of my age that has never read nor seen this book until last week when I read it.
So I'm glad to assign you homework.
Yes, absolutely.
Impactful homework.
I'm broadening my horizons, yes.
And so this is, I will do my best to stick to the 1996 novel Fight Club. The movie, of course, was its own cultural phenomenon.
Yeah.
Bringing forth Ed Norton, who was fairly well known, and Brad Pitt, who was very well known, to suddenly be huge stars. Mm-hmm. This is the movie that kind of made them in a lot of ways. You know, they were headliners. But this book itself is, I think this is a good book for us to talk about for a few reasons. First, the two of us read it in high school.
Mm-hmm.
But on top of that, it's one of those books and one of those movies that a lot of people misinterpret, I think. Mm-hmm. And they, I think, get it wrong. And in an era where toxic masculinity has led to a lot of chaos, you could argue things like Jan 6 and some of these white supremacist movements could read a lot wrong mm-hmm. into this book. I think it's worth talking about in a more academic, teacherly way because these themes, these topics, these, at one point he says, we're the first generation of men raised by women. And you're just like, oh, I know exactly who's talking here.
Mm-hmm.
I think it provides for an interesting discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm really interested too with this conversation. Mike, you're saying that you hadn't read it before. I know that I did read it for high school. I read it for Jay Pollock, Mr. Pollock's AP Lit class my senior year. And we read it as part of our curriculum. But I had seen the movie before I read the book.
Oh, wow. Okay.
In a lot of ways, kind of the spoil of Tyler Durden was something that I knew was coming. But for a couple of books that I can remember reading, I still was very engaged in the text, even though I had seen the movie first. And that's a rarity for me. Most often, if I've seen the movie first, I might at some point come around to the book, but I always find myself kind of reacting lacklusterly to the text if I've seen the movie first. But I really liked the book. But I'm interested in this discussion because, Mike, there is such a monumentous kind of twist with the narrator and Tyler Durden that's in
right.
this, that's really at the heart of this story. And growing up up on the North Shore of Boston at an all-boys private Catholic high school where this movie was the thing. I mean, everybody had seen the movie. Everybody that was in the AP Lit curriculum had read the book. So there was no way that I was going to be encountering this story without any sort of without understanding some of the twists and some of the surprises that end up coming with it. Did you know about any of
that? No, I mean, I knew, you know, the first rule about Fight Club and all those sort of sayings that you hear a lot of. And, of course, the meme with the very ripped Brad Pitt that, like, is, you know, everywhere and still, like, people are like, get the Brad Pitt Fight Club body workout and all that stuff. So that's really all I knew of it. And I knew it was violent and sort of dystopic, but I didn't know the, and I don't know if we'll give away the spoiler, but I didn't know that twist. And as I was reading it, I was like, I had to go back and kind of like, wait, what? Did that, what? Okay.
Okay, yeah, so
it did surprise me.
I was going to say, I don't know if you guys are like totally opposed to this, but there is a big spoiler. Dun, 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 dun. We learned that the narrator is indeed Tyler Durden. As the story unfolds, this character of Tyler ends up being the same as our unnamed narrator. And so, Mike, for reading it through the first time, because of course this time I listened to it on audiobook as I was rather than reading through it. But even still, all the little references to these characters never being in the same place at the same time, or if you fall asleep in one place and don't wake up until the plane lands, can you wake up as somebody else if you wake up in this totally different location? Were you? I'm so intrigued by somebody's first reading of this to know you didn't see that coming. What was some?
No, I mean I didn't see it coming at all. Yeah. And so again, just because I knew the film and Brad Pitt and Ed Norton and just sort of the visual of that as two separate. I don't even know in the movie how do they do that? Is it switched? I mean, I know this is a podcast about the book, but.
So what it looks like in some ways is kind of very Matrix-y, where you'll have the two of them in a scene, and then one will kind of glitch out and then disappear and then come back in, and then he'll be in the background.
So Ed Norton is the narrator?
Ed Norton is the narrator. Is that
Joe? Yeah.
And then Tyler Durden is Brad Pitt.
Okay.
And so the way they do it is, at first, it's almost as though Brad Pitt is a real person who kind of looks different and happens to be in the seat next to him on an airplane.
Yeah.
They don't have the beach scene. He's just a guy on an airplane. And then the next time we see him, he has frosted tips because it's exactly 1999.
Yeah.
And he just kind of appears in Ed Norton's life. We have the explosion in his apartment.
Right.
And then he needs a place to crash, and he has in his pocket the business card that Brad Pitt gives him, and he just goes to that house.
And then later on, if I'm remembering correctly, the movie, I haven't seen the movie in years, but if I'm remembering correctly, they have kind of like a montage where in I think true to the book, the narrator realizes that he is indeed Tyler Durden when the bartender kind of messes up.
So you were here just last week, right?
Exactly. Was explaining that he was here just a week ago. And in the movie, in the book, they have kind of like a really quick snippet where it's like where he is realizing this big twist. In the movie, they have like a really mini montage of him beating himself up outside of the bar and all of these kind of like clips where it could only have been possible if they were the same, if they were the same person. And that's if I'm remembering the movie correctly, which again,
how did they do in the film the meet scene? Because like he first meets Tyler Durden on the beach, right? In the book.
Yeah, he's just kind of on a new.
Like he falls asleep finally, and then wakes up, and Tyler's there. But how do they do that in the film?
So he's the character. Brad Pitt is in the movie early on as a dude on the airplane, and then the way he kind of re-enters his life is very slapdash. Like again, he needs a place to stay, and so he just shows up. And it's not Project Mayhem that blows up his apartment. It's Tyler Durden.
Right.
And that's how we get to that scene.
Okay. But no, to answer your question, I was totally surprised. Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. I mean, and in this way, it's very. I get to talk about comics for a second. This is Frank Miller's Batman. In that, Bruce Wayne is a myth, right? It's Batman who's the person, and here we know Tyler Durden's name. We don't know our main character's name, and so in that way, his impulse is to be Tyler Durden, which is interesting. You know, we know more about his imaginary friend than we do about our main character.
Right.
Which is, I guess, kind of the point of the novel. We are the facade we put on, right?
And I got to ask you, Mike, and then you might remember this, Nick, but going to an all-boys school, was there a fight club? Did there start a fight club?
The first rule of Fight Club, Mike, is that you can't talk
but
about
there
fight
was
club.
A fight club. Girls were fighting up at Blackburn. Dude, do you remember that, Nick?
Yes, that was, I think, a grade beneath me. It was a colleague of mine, Kevin Moore's year. It was a class of 2004.
Yeah.
But yeah, they would go up to Blackburn Park and just beat the crap out of each other.
And then immediately you guys stopped reading Fight Club at Marist? Is that the
I think that was the last year they did it. Yeah.
No, well, the To the best of my knowledge, no.
Right. Okay.
There wasn't a Fight Club that emerged at St. John's Prep up in Danvers, Massachusetts. But no, the following that this book and that this movie had was unlike any other. I mean, the number of yearbook quotes that came from Fight Club, and it. I think that there's a couple of reasons for that. I think that the obviously the movie did a number on the kind of cool edginess and having Brad Pitt and Edward Norton as a part of this this gritty, edgy kind of like anarchy text that we, it almost felt like I was like we were being like rebels in some way by reading it in our button-down shirts and our khaki pants and
sure
and it felt like it was this cool,
subversive
edgy
that way
thing.
Absolutely yeah.
And so I think that the you can imagine I'm sure what that does to the persona of a 16 or 17 year old boy who's reading through it. I mean, we would watch the movie, and I think that we watched part of it in class. I might be wrong about that, but I can just remember like idolizing these characters, but also idolizing a little bit of the writing too. Like it was one of the, and I know I was saying this beforehand, and I'll get into it a little bit later on, but writing about Fight Club in class was one of the first times that I ever wrote a close reading essay, and really I started to kind of idolize Chuck Palahniuk's writing and kind of some of the cool things and the tropes and the metaphors and some of the intricacies of the writing that he includes in the text that I thought were really cool as well. So I think that part of my fascination looking back and some of my intrigue in reading it for the first time is wrapped up in kind of like the coolness of the text. And I think that that's as much testimony to Chuck Palahniuk, perhaps definitely more to Chuck Palahniuk than it would be even to the persona of Tyler Durden.
So can you speak to that? I mean, what appealed to you about his style, or how would you describe the style? And then both then as a 16-year-old and now as, you know, a writer yourself.
Yeah, I think the some of the kind of like the topic material, and of course Danvers, Massachusetts, and where I grew up in the Merrimack Valley of the North Shore of Massachusetts, very kind of like suburbia. So just the setting being kind of like entrenched in a city, and the light of the movie version as well, it's super dark.
Mm-hmm.
And understandably, I mean, it needs to take place at nighttime, so a great deal of it is taking place at night. But it's also this kind of like really gritty setting and gritty story, and some of the language and the topic matter and the anarchy and the driving the car on the wrong side of the highway, and the there's just like a grittiness to it that I think was intriguing, if nothing else. It was just a world totally separate and devoid from what I had grown up with and what it is that I knew, and so that was kind of thematically, I guess you could say, part of what was intriguing about it. But the twist that I did know was coming from having seen the movie before reading the book, it kind of showed me that you can write cool, lack of a better phrase. And I don't know, I think that that's something that I kind of take with me after going through it again.
So my question for both of you is, like, how would you teach this, or how was it taught to you in class, or how active?
I mean, for me, it was summer,
just summer reading, so you just read it.
So I read it, and it was discussion. And I mean, it's good for that, because I feel like you read it, you get it. Now, like you said, there are parts of it you could do a deeper reading on, mm-hmm. but if you just gave it to a kid and told them to read it, I think they'd understand it.
Yeah.
Now, in that kind of legalistic way we have to teach sometimes, this was an optional book, and I chose to read this, which I think is important for some of the mm-hmm. topic here.
Yeah, for sure.
But, you know, I don't know. Like, I remember when consuming this book, I was probably 16 or 17, maybe 17, and there's some parts to it that are not just dense, but it's clearly he says it's Gatsby-esque, which it is.
Yeah.
But it's a very dark philosophy on consumerism and living in, at his point, the end of the millennium. The spoils decade of the millennium. And I kind of, I want to say I got it. You know, the idea that, you know, he's living in an apartment that explodes and he goes, all the things I've ever had were in there. Like, as though he is nothing except for his stuff.
Right. Yeah. All his IKEA furniture.
Yeah. Yeah. And the idea of them making soap out of the fat sucked out of people and selling it back to them. Yeah. Like, that kind of critique on capitalism and mm-hmm. stuff, I got. But, of course, there is this testosterone-drivenness that clearly was gotten out of it, even if it's mm-hmm. not the intention. I see this as a book that's often misread. I think it would have been helpful to have a little bit more direction in mm-hmm. analyzing it. So,
misread as people don't... You're saying it should be read as a satire and people aren't getting that or missing the dark humor of it?
I mean, I think it's very funny at times. Other times, I think it's not. But I think when people read this, they see the fact. If you start thinking that Tyler Durden is right about anything, you're in trouble. Mm. You know, like the idea that you need to feel masculine, you need to be able to be aggressive, that society is based on, you know, these structured rules which we have no control over, et cetera, and that destabilization is very easy. Mm. This book, I don't think, would have come out 5 years later because that's 9/11. Mm. And we saw, if anything... Well,
especially the part about the building, right?
Yeah.
The tallest building, like, I mean, it's essentially based in Chicago instead of New York, right? At the time, the Sears Tower was the tallest, now the Willis Tower. Mm. But, you know, bringing it down, blowing it up. But, yeah, we even talked about it on 9/11. When we talked about 9/11, rather. Before the second building was hit, people really were standing down, watching what was happening, drawn to it. Sure. That's what they're talking about. The whole scene of, before we get to the crowded scene satire, where everyone just shows up from the groups and like, we're here to help. You know, people are watching, like, wall after wall fall down, the desks be thrown out the window, and everyone's just standing down below watching. It's interesting. I think this book has a philosophy it understands. I just don't know if I was smart enough to get the turn until I reread it when I was in college or whenever I reread it the first
time. Was yours more hands-on, as far as teaching it, as you're reading it?
Yeah, and I think that that's simply by virtue of the fact that it was part of the curriculum versus being taught or being
auxiliary,
not taught during summer reading. But I remember writing for my first ever, like, really close reading piece, writing it based off of the first time that the narrator and Tyler Durden are talking about hitting rock bottom, which is kind of a trope that ends up coming back up again and again and again throughout the story. And I don't have the text on me that I had written. But I like to hope, I like to think that maybe I was able in that close reading to loop in some of the Christ allegory that I think is present there. And I'd love to get into that with you guys once we go through the plot, which I know that we'll do in just a second. But I wrote a close reading on probably like a page and a half to 3 pages worth of the text talking about the concept of hitting rock bottom that comes up during that conversation between the narrator and between Tyler Durden. And I remember thinking to myself as I was writing it, I was like, this is great. Yeah. I don't have to know what happens in the rest of the chapters. I don't have to analyze what happens after this point. I just have to look at these 3 pages. This is awesome. And it kind of set the framework for papers moving forward. If I wasn't sure what to write about, well, I'm just going to do a close reading because I have a lot less text that I need to worry about with that. So that took me through probably like sophomore year of college. But nevertheless, yeah, I can remember being in class and talking about some of those tropes. I can't remember if we got into some of like kind of the Christ figures and the three persons in one narrator, so to speak, and some of the allusions that are made to the Bible. and indeed kind of like a resurrection and the life after death that comes at the end of the text as well. But I can remember getting into some of the themes and of masculinity, some of the themes of identity. I can remember talking about the different passages of the soap and the symbolism of the soap, and so we got pretty nitty gritty with it. And I can remember being in the class and kind of almost chapter by chapter going through it. So that's a very different reading and a very different scenario, Nick. I know that than how you encountered it.
Yeah.
But with that, I think that it helped maybe to have a teacher who, and Jay, I still talk with Jay. He's one of the probably the most influential teacher that I've had. And so having somebody that I thought that highly of and still think that highly of kind of walk me through the text, I think that helped to provide some of the guardrails, for lack of a better word, Nick, that kind of helped to shape my understanding of what the text was saying about masculinity. It helped me to understand what the ideologies were that were behind it and what the text meant about identity and lack of identity in some of these instances. So I think that was certainly influential and helped to guide my reading.
So was your teacher, just thinking about the idea of masculinity, toxic masculinity or satire, was your teacher prescriptive in saying, like, this is the reading, or would he just sort of ask the questions and you as a class would
discuss it
your own way?
It was definitely more of a discussion-based class than anything else. So I think that, if anything, it would be we'd go to some of the passages that were, like, some of the Big Bob descriptions of masculinity and kind of like read through the passage together as a class and then have it thrown out kind of like, what do you think of this? Where do you see some of the lines here that are kind of guiding your reading one way or the other? And I think at the same time, I might be wrong about this, but I think it was when we were going through a contemporary poetry unit as well, because we read a lot for this class. And so I think that it was almost a lesson in treating novels with that close reading skill, with the same attention to detail that you do with poetry, that I think combining those skills was something that was also kind of at the heart of the class. So just bringing us to some of those passages and introducing some of the themes and kind of opening the doors to say, well, what do you guys think about this? Was kind of more of the direction that it took.
That's good. Mike, do you want to do a plot synopsis? Do you want me to? What are you feeling?
I'll leave it to you guys.
Yeah, I was going to say I've got something quick here that I can kind of just make our way through if you guys are good with it, and you can stop me along the way as we go through it. So it starts off with a narrator, an unnamed narrator, who is an insomniac, can't sleep, and is kind of he's in the world of product recall. So he's he works for a product recall. I don't know what you would call it necessarily, like a company. I know that he works for, we never get the name of it, but a car company in their product recall,
almost
division.
Like an actuary, though.
Yeah.
Like he parses like exactly how much it'll cost to recall versus the cost of how many deaths.
Yeah,
or something.
And it's such a dark reading of just humanity. And that's really what you're introduced to at the start of this story, is the formulaic kind of nature of humanity, which now that I'm just kind of spiraling here, but just thinking about what that means at the end of the story when our narrator encounters God and he's talking about how, well, people aren't good or bad, they just kind of are. It's kind of very much in alignment with, from the very beginning of the story, that reading of what humanity is worth as, like, A times B equals C, or A times B or plus C, or whatever that formula was. But anyways, he's not able to sleep, and so he ends up going to these support groups so that he can start to feel.
On his doctor's order,
yes,
right?
On his doctor's orders. His doctor tells him that, well, in being an insomniac isn't necessarily the problem. It's always kind of characteristic of something else that's bigger.
Right.
But you're not really sick, so go and see what real sick people are like, and that'll help you to be able to sleep. And it does work. He goes to these support groups, and he ends up being able to sleep until he meets Marla, who's described as being a tourist in this world of these support groups. She's a faker, like he is, who does not actually have these different sicknesses or illnesses,
which are all terminal, right?
Terminal illnesses, that are leading to these other people that are on their deathbed, and so he and Marla are described as these kind of like tourists and fakers in this instance, and the presence of Marla keeps him from being able to sleep. So he confronts Marla during one of these meetings, and as a result of this, there's a lot of therapeutic processes that they try to make their way through in terms of opening up doors and what is your spirit animal. And eventually our narrator confronts ends up confronting Marla and saying, you're a faker, we can't keep doing this, you're keeping me from being able to sleep. So they decide that they're going to split up and go to different support groups in order to allow for both of them to be able to sleep. We get the meeting of Tyler Durden on a nude beach, which is so interesting. He's got nothing to cover himself up in the book. Again, this is different than in the movie. I think in the movie, he's just happens to be the person that's sitting next to him on the airplane. But in the book, he meets Tyler Durden on a nude beach. Shortly after that, his condo is destroyed. We learn later on that it was indeed Tyler Durden who destroyed his condo. But as we know from earlier on in this podcast, Tyler Durden and our narrator are actually the same person. So he calls up Tyler Durden after his condo has been destroyed. Doesn't know where it is that he's going to go. So he calls up the only number that he has in his back pocket. He calls up Tyler. They go to a bar and get some drinks, and then that's when the line of "I want you to hit me as hard as you can" ends up coming from. So they get kind of like into just on the outside of this bar, end up getting into this bar fight, which is kind of the inspiration behind the creation of Fight Club, which are these secret underground battle arenas where people really beat down on one another until one of the contestants says that they need to stop. So it's this kind of like self-destructive method of reaching rock bottom that Tyler and the narrator start to make their way into creating. It starts off as just one, and then they start to kind of branch out from there. But that's kind of like the inciting plot events, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, no, that's good. And just as kind of catch you up with the author himself, Chuck was a blue-collar guy. He was a trucker for Freightline Trucks. And he felt very little about that. So he started working at a homeless shelter and volunteering at hospice places. And then a dude he got very close to died. Mm-hmm. And that's when he started writing. And you kind of see these are people who are forgotten by society, and that's kind of what this whole thing is. It's a very class-conscious book. Whether or not it's successful in that, we can talk about. But, you know, the people who join Fight Club, like, are always the secretaries. They're always the people in the background. Mm-hmm. And it's the people who notice that they're beat up are the managers, are mm-hmm. the people on the floor, the people who are in charge of the meeting, and he's just in the side working the slideshow. Mm-hmm. And so it's a bunch of waiters. It's a bunch of, you know, barbacks that sign up for Fight Club, which is interesting. This is also his first novel, which kind of, well, it's his second. His first one was rejected. Then he wrote Fight Club, which was huge. And so everything else has been published since then. The only character I guess we didn't really talk about yet is Big Bob.
Big Bob, yeah.
Big Bob is someone who had testicular cancer. He was a bodybuilder. And so he gets it from the steroids. And then they get his hormones wrong, so he's grown breasts, played by Meatloaf in the movie.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. but he's interesting because when they become Project Mayhem, he's the only one who dies.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's the one who should not have been let in. He's the one that our narrator says, no, don't give up. Well, the one person, he broke Tyler's rules, so he had to die. Like, it's just a very interesting parallel here. There really aren't that many characters, kind of.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people, but mm-hmm. the people who matter are Tyler, our narrator, who I called him Joe. At one point, there's a series of, like, self-help magazines, mm-hmm. and they refer to organs as people. I am Joe's lungs. Right. I am Joe's.
Yeah.
And so the only name we hear him say often is Tyler and Joe. So right. it's yeah. Joe, but he is unnamed. We have Marla Singer. Mm-hmm. We have Big Bob. And then I guess Angel Face.
Yeah, yeah. And, but there are some like other ancillary characters. There's like a mechanic. Uh-huh. There's Angel Face, whose really only role in the story is to be something beautiful that's destroyed, right? And then you get his boss, but all of these other characters don't get names. So it is very interesting who gets a name and who doesn't get a name. And I think that it does kind of like come back to that notion of identity, because Big Bob does get a name, and he's referenced so that his tie into the theme of masculinity as being this bodybuilder who then loses all of his aspects that would make him stereotypically masculine and takes on the characteristics that would make him stereotypically feminine.
Right.
And yet it's in the midst of this kind of like this transition that he encounters the narrator that he
cries.
Encounters.
Cries.
That, yeah,
and,
exactly.
On his bosom, right? In his breast.
Right. And it's these encounters with a once masculine, now feminine character that allows for the narrator to have this cathartic experience, and it's right after that that he's able to sleep. So it's almost as though this notion of insomnia and what it really is that's at the root of this character's problems does have some heart, does have some kind of core in masculinity.
Well, and if there is a moral to it, it's in this character, which right. is feeling emotions is what allows him to sleep. Mm-hmm. Sharing this moment with other men in a positive way is good. The yeah. second that breaks down is when Tyler shows up and ruins the world.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and leads to Bob's death. Had he stopped here,
yeah.
this is an okay. And again, like that's how the morality play plays on.
Yeah.
But you know, if there's a baptism scene, it's yeah. here. He's crying with someone else. This is yeah. his John the Baptist scene. But John has to die brutally here.
Would you then say that Tyler, on the uber masculine side of things, would be a foil to Big Bob? Would that be?
Yeah, I mean,
you think too much of a reading of it, or
no? I think he's in if you're classically interpreting the Bible in this way, he's the adversary,
right?
He's the devil. He's the one mm-hmm. who's tempting, like these messages, mm-hmm. right? You know, this is our narrator's time in the desert, which is, you know, it's an interesting structure, because in some ways, this novel's pretty sparse. It's, what, a tight 200 pages?
Yeah.
And you get a lot out of it in that time period. The book doesn't really slow mm-hmm. down ever. Even the scenes where you're talking about, he's on planes a lot. It's done like a very quick montage.
Yeah.
You wake up in CPAC. You fall asleep in Hartsfield. You wake up in Midway. Like, it's great.
Yeah, and I think that it narratively, it does jump around a lot, which can make it a little bit difficult to follow in terms of its plot, but I do think that it adds to the kind of dislodging effect that the text has. I think
totally.
That
it's
disorienting, and I think that it's meant to be, because you have a narrator that is in that weird in-between stage of
schizophrenic.
Sleep.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So kind of continuing along through the plot for the next couple of chapters, we get
We should get the rules of Fight Club.
Yes.
You introduce Fight Club, right?
Yeah.
Cliche alert.
Yeah.
That's right.
Here it comes.
So you've heard this one before, I guarantee it.
Yes. Well, at least you've heard the first two, right? We should also mention it's funny that men can be emotional unless a woman's there.
Yeah.
Right. Which is the Marlin thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so the first rule is you don't talk about Fight Club. The second rule, bold and italicized, you don't talk about Fight Club.
Mm-hmm.
Rule number three, when someone says stop, taps out, or goes limp, the fight is over. Step four, rule four, there's only two guys to a fight. Rule five, one fight at a time. This performative, right? You've got to be yeah. masculine in front of others. They fight without shoes or shirts. The fights go on as long as they have to. And if this is your first night at Fight Club, you have to fight. So before you know what you're expecting,
mm-hmm.
you have to fight. So those are the eight rules. The first time we really get them, Tyler's reading them out, kind of. He's improvising.
Mm-hmm.
But then we get a hard copy because he prints them off at work, which mm-hmm. is the first time the boss kind of knows the world that he has been thrust into.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now we have it.
Yeah. You know, so now we know what the Fight Club is, and now we can I guess kind of dive deeper into the intricacies of it. No, that's a good point, Nick. So as these now Fight Clubs are continuing along, we get Marla, who attempts to overdose and is rescued by Tyler. putting that in air quotes, because of course Tyler is the same as our narrator. And then we get some of the lines there where, Mike, I'm sure that I would be interested to see if you were not knowing that Tyler and the narrator were the same person. We get a lot of the lines that's at the time in re-listening to it through the audiobook that I noticed so many times them talking about them possibly, if Tyler and the narrator are never in the same place,
right.
Marla must never know the distinction between them.
Right.
And it's such an interesting kind of identity overlap there.
Well, there's also the line that we get a lot, which is, I know this because Tyler
knows
this.
Yes, exactly.
Which is a nice way to say it. One hand, if you don't know the twist, We're attached at the hip, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, we're just always together. But on the other hand, it's a nice way to set it up.
Yeah.
I'll leave it there.
Yeah, so kind of from that point, we get the Project Mayhem that kind of evolves from Fight Club, which is this kind of anarchy movement that becomes a kind of the next generation of Fight Club. It almost kind of like evolves into this greater series of anarchy where the different members of Project Mayhem end up standing outside of the narrator / Tyler's house and kind of like wanting to earn their acceptance into Project Mayhem, and they're turned away in the same way as a Buddhist ritual to help them reach rock bottom. There it is again. Before being accepted into this project where they are described as, quote, space monkeys, which are kind of this, I don't know, simile for these valueless animals that are just kind of part of the bigger scheme.
I view that as consumerist, right? Use them up and you throw them away. It's totally disposable, but they're human beings.
Absolutely, right? Disposable, which is so similar to that disposable nature with the product recall and the valueless nature of humanity from the beginning of it. So anyways, Project Mayhem is this series of kind of like destructive events around the city that's meant to kind of almost inspire terror in some ways, and it's definitely anti-consumeristic. And it's in the midst of this Project Mayhem that Big Bob does end up dying, and that's kind of the linchpin that causes the narrator to want to shut down Fight Club. It's gone too far. Big Bob has been killed. This is somebody that means a great deal to the narrator, and so he tries to stop Fight Club, and that's I guess what we'll hit pause and see if you guys have anything else to say.
Sure. We should talk, I mean, briefly as well. This book is kind of about mental health, obviously. At first, our narrator, they don't say what's wrong with him, as you alluded to. In fact, the doctor says, you know, get some exercise and chew on valerian root, which is fantastic late 90s nonsense, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what does Marla try to overdose on? Xanax, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the drug that may in fact have helped our narrator, something, you know, that is anti-anxiety and puts you to sleep. But throughout it, there's this kind of eschewing of, I mean, a very Freudian psychology in replacement of masculinity. Like, let's just beat the crap out of each other, and then he sleeps again.
Yeah.
Now, it turns out that's a dangerous sleep, because that's when Tyler goes on. And about the point you stopped, we stop seeing Tyler.
Yeah.
And this is when the narrator has to catch up with the plot. He's not aware of what's going on. Once Marla shows up, in fact, Tyler appears less and less and less and less and less. And it turns out it's because he's working on Project Mayhem, like you alluded to, which has its own five rules, which we'll get to in a second. But we don't even get the rules from Tyler. We get the rules from people talking about Tyler,
because
Tyler's now gone.
Mm-hmm.
The beginning third, he's working for his company. The middle third, he's working on his own as one of these like hourly wage schlub type people.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final third, he's trying to clean up and stop Project Mayhem. They aren't exactly even sections, but that's how you know, the act structure kind of works here.
What I'm just thinking as you guys are talking, so there's a theme of like the seen and the unseen. Mm-hmm. Right? What's on the surface and what's hidden.
Yeah.
Like the secrecy of that. But then what do you make of his, like Tyler's job as a projectionist, where he's splicing pornography, like little bits of pornography in normal films? Like, why is that in there? What is that? Because it's subversive, as a lot of it is, but yeah, I don't know. Like, nobody can see it long enough. It's not on screen enough to appreciate. So what's the point of that?
They do a good job with that in the movie.
Yeah.
Oh, do they?
But yeah, I part of it is, I would imagine it's the anarchy of the situation, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's.
And it just escalates?
Is that, well, it's escalation.
Start with that, and then in order to feel a high or feel something like similar to beating yourself up, you got to do more, and that's what leads to project.
Yeah, I could definitely see that being the case.
We're being numbed out in this consumer society. Is that what it is?
Partially, I'd say. I'd say it's also partially the idea that we're fed those commercial messages through these big market movies, and so by disrupting them, we're disrupting their message. You know, who's the attacking? I think the only examples we get directly are Disney movies, right, as a way to subvert the messages that we're told from a very young age.
What you don't see is harming you, like the peeing in the soup and farting on the cream brulee and all that stuff. Yeah, I don't know. I'm just...
No, it's interesting.
the line about I wouldn't order the chowder is the one that gets me, yeah.
I mean, and then, you know, to that, to wit, it's a projectionist. It's the person you never see that controls your experience.
Yeah. Literally projecting. It's Tyler Durden is a projection, right?
Yeah.
It's... That's one of those metaphors that I imagine if you're teaching, you're like, hey, look at this. It's good. And again, he's invisible, which makes us wonder, again, our narrator, how long has he been doing these things? Because he has to then be the projectionist at a certain point.
For how long has Tyler been putting these messages subliminally into the narrator, right? It's definitely there.
And then just, again, another question for you guys. So as far as the rules of Fight Club, is that what the author is saying, like there's a prescribed definition of masculinity and like it, but it's hidden, you don't talk about it, and there's a certain way that you can be masculine versus,
so not just what's not seen but what's not spoken too. You don't talk about Fight Club, you know, like it. And I think that there's definitely an element of that, and then at the same time also the fact where the lines about he makes the narrator promise you're not going to talk about Tyler. So you can't bring up the name Tyler Durden to Marla because otherwise it's going to bring the whole thing crumbling down. So I think that logistically there's an aspect of Fight Club and Tyler Durden being one and the same, where you don't talk about Fight Club, you don't talk about Tyler Durden. So it kind of like allows for all of these kind of unspoken of events to kind of transpire and for this to escalate the way that it ends up that it ends up going through. But it's so interesting to me, and again, I kind of wish that I had that paper back from high school. I think that in some ways if I were to read through it, it would not be it would be disappointing in some ways. But the line where he says that's three times, you promised me three times, which is so biblical, right? Of the denouncing of the,
Peter,
Peter's denouncing of Jesus three times. And I just think that that's so tightly wound, and I love just how succinct that is in kind of the forming of that Christ figure. And I doubt that I picked up on it when I was reading through it the first time in high school, but I was really intrigued by those moments reading back through it.
Well, and it's interesting as well to what you were talking about, Mike. What you were talking about, Burns, I have to clarify. Project Mayhem's five rules. You don't ask questions. No excuses, no lies. You have to trust Tyler. I mean, what he's making is a terrorist group, clearly. Right. But again, you know, I'm freeing you from society and you can't challenge me on that.
Sure. Right? Here are the rules for anarchy, which is self-contradictory in its own way. Right, yeah.
When we get to the end, I do have a philosophical question about all of this. But just for a second to talk about Mayhem. What I think is interesting about the style of the book is because our narrator is unconscious so much of it, we're learning as he learns. He stumbles into Mayhem already in progress, and he's like, and we get the names of these committees and how they meet different nights of the week as though it's the 4-H Center, and, you know, and Thursday is misinformation. And every so often you come across, like, when they're driving down the street in that stolen car, and he's like, I drive better when I'm drunk, bumper stickers. He goes, yeah, that was mischief, right? Like, or was it misinformation? And they're like, anyway, it's bleeding into each other. It's becoming more and more chaotic. It's incredible. And what we're doing is building up to the ultimate terrorist attack, which is bringing down a skyscraper. And he talks about how if you hit it on the support beams low enough, the top will collapse down and the whole thing will fall over. And imagine the newspapers the next day. A building at 100% at 80 degrees and like 45 degrees, then it toppling and then dust. And I'm just like, holy shit, this is 1996.
Yeah, yeah. And the whole purpose there, I think, is to like destroy the like National History Museum or something like that. It's supposed to come crumbling down on this kind of like emblem of
the past.
The past and this emblem of like the America and where it is that the foundation upon which America has been rooted.
So. And the dark humor of that, like the tallest building, obviously a penis, right? Very phallic, right? Oh, yeah, deflating that, right? Mm-hmm. So
I guess I'll kind of just push us towards the end of the story until kind of like the last third here. So we're already talking about the plot and the plan to destroy the National Museum with explosives. Marla ends up coming to a support group. This is after the narrator has had that moment at the bar. I guess I should go back. The narrator is kind of in the midst of, he's been kicked out of Project Mayhem and Fight Club because he tried to stop it. And it's at the point where this movement has become bigger than the narrator. It's become bigger than Tyler. And so even Tyler / the narrator is not immune to the antics of Project Mayhem and Fight Club. And so he tries to end it, which means that all of his disciples, for lack of a better word, are now onto him to kind of like kick him out of Fight Club and to allow for Project Mayhem to still continue along the way that it was going. So Tyler ends up taking a step back. Marla meets with Tyler, or meets with our narrator, in a support group because our narrator calls Marla and wants to make sure that, because Tyler could be listening, he doesn't want for Marla to be in any more danger than she has to be. And they schedule a meeting where they met the first time, which was of course at that support group meeting. And I love that moment in the text because everything has been totally flipped around. You get the narrator who's looking at Marla, who is now scowling at him from across the room. It's Marla who then comes and confronts the narrator. It's Marla that comes up and slaps the narrator, and it's Marla who is kind of like on the complete, the kind of like on the aggressive, whereas when they first met during that scene in earlier on in the story, it was the narrator that came aggressively towards Marla, and it was the narrator that was scowling and glaring at Marla the entire time. But anyways, there was this moment in Project Mayhem that Marla is saying that she witnessed the death of somebody and it wasn't supposed to, or that she thinks that Project Mayhem has gone too far. It was essentially like a dinner party where they were doing a murder mystery, thank you. Like a murder mystery dinner party, and somebody ends up actually being killed as part of Project Mayhem. And Marla thinks that the narrator and Tyler has gone too far. And it's after this that the narrator kind of makes the decision to, I don't know if you want to call it, like to destroy Tyler, to kind of bring an end to Fight Club or Project Mayhem, but he goes up to the building that's supposed to be exploded and topple down on the National Museum. And so we get kind of this almost like held at gunpoint, which I think is important to reference that this is how the story starts. We start with Tyler's gun being in the mouth of our narrator, mm-hmm. which is now coming full circle, and we kind of see where it is that that's all coming from. As our narrator now is in this room, ready to watch the world around him burn. And Marla comes crashing in with all of these support group people that are there to help. And it's almost, I don't know, it's almost kind of like too cliched for me of this moment of the like the like and the love, and it's like it's all been about love all along, and I don't know if it really fits necessarily with kind of like the tone of the gravity of everything that's going on at the moment. But we get the fact that Tyler mixed the wrong explosives or used the wrong chemical compound in the explosives, and as a result of this, the explosion did not take place, and the narrator ends up pulling the trigger, destroying Tyler, but not quite himself. We get kind of this moment where we get kind of like a resurrection, where our narrator goes and talks to God, and we get one of the most interesting views of God, I think, that I've seen in many texts, which is he's sitting kind of like behind the desk with all of the important diplomas and things that are behind him, and he gets into an argument with God and calls God a liar for God still standing by the point that there are good people, there is goodness, there is evil, and the narrator just says that no, just people are people, and that's just the end of it. And so he calls God a liar, and then wakes up in what I think we're supposed to assume is a mental institution, where he's being kind of helped by these different employees in this mental institution who are saying, "Can't wait to get you back out there, Tyler." And so it's kind of like the while we get the narrator who seems to have come to almost a near cathartic experience at the end of this would-be tragedy, we still get the continuation of his disciples that are at work even after the death, again, putting that in air quotes, of Tyler Durden. Mm-hmm. So it kind of brings our plot to a close.
Very good. So a couple things we should mention here. First, this is the book slash movie that gives us the term snowflake. Mm. I am not a perfect snowflake.
Is that where that comes from?
This is where it comes from.
No, I didn't know that.
And then second, this is where I'm curious whether or not you think or who's in control. Mm. One of the first lines we get at the beginning, it's right out of the Anarchist Cookbook. There are three ways to make napalm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mix petroleum and blah, 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 styrofoam, orange concentrate. Like, he goes through these things. We get how to make a bomb when you're rendering fat to make soap. The glycerin flows to the top.
And human you mix fat, it with this. We should say,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go. And then we get the scene where he's like, if you're making dynamite, you take the nitroglycerin and you mix it with sawdust or with paraffin. But I could never get it to work with paraffin. Mm. Then at the end, the bomb doesn't go off because the narrator made it with paraffin, and Tyler's furious with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's his will fighting back. Like, yeah. And so my question is, like, is that on purpose? Is this the character trying to find his humanity? Because it's an interesting way to do it, by undermining Tyler by making his bombs wrong.
Mm.
I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, I think that I can't decide what I think at the end of the story too. Right. You know, like it's,
because we did already kill his boss by making a bomb out of the old CRT monitor.
Yeah.
We because when he blew up the apartment, he wasn't there. No one was hurt.
Yeah.
Right. The fact that Marla turns and we turn are when people start to die.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like, yeah, the pranks. Yeah, the harassment is not great. We get the scene where he has the chief of police and he's essentially going to castrate him like a dog. We get it constantly. You castrate your pets. You love them, but you castrate them.
Yeah.
And we have this threat against first several chiefs of police, especially, I think, Chicago. And then they try to get Tyler. They try to get our narrator.
Yeah.
But, you know, the people who die are the boss when the monitor explodes, mm-hmm. and the person who I think was like the recycling guy, yeah. Who was trying to shut them down.
And Big Bob, right?
And Big Bob,
and,
right.
And I think that's important too, Nick, just along with what it is that you're saying, because think about the view of humanity and the narrator's view of humanity as being kind of like a number in a formula back at the start of the story. And yet, so at the start of the story, it seems as though people don't have any value. And yet, it's not until Big Bob dies that the narrator, it seems as though there's so much value to human life, to that one human life, that to our narrator, it's worthy of destroying the whole thing, of bringing all of Fight Club down, bringing it to an end, stopping the entire thing. He says, I think that we've done all that we can do here, and that Fight Club needs to end. And of course, the movement has become so much bigger than that. But the narrator, this is the same narrator that was saying earlier on that people are just a number and a formula to decide whether a product should be recalled or not. And now we get that one human life that has the ability to cause the narrator to shut down everything that it is that he's done. So I think that that you're right. For Marla, for the narrator, and for the reader as well, we get this impression that there is value to life, and that's the point where you can't cross that line. Now for Tyler and for his disciples, the space monkeys, that line is that the cause is still bigger, that the greater good, or the greater good of Project Mayhem, is more important than the value of human life. And so I think that it's setting up that dichotomy very, very importantly for us. And I think that the line goes right at Big Bob.
Well, and I'll read a quote here, but we have to remember that the general like, we have a stratified society, but that most people are meaningless and the same, right? The boss is described as having cornflower blue eyes, but he also has a specific tie for each day of the week. Yeah. And we even get, oh, it must be Wednesday because he's wearing blah, 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 blah. And our narrator has a blue tie with red stripes and a red tie with blue stripes and five white shirts that go with him everywhere, right?
Yeah.
And so we get the line from the mechanic. If you're a male and you're Christian, you're living in America, your father is your model for God. And if you've never known your father, if your father bails out or dies or is never home, what do you believe about God? How Tyler saw it was getting God's attention for being bad was better than getting no attention at all. Maybe because God's hate is better than his indifference. If you could be either God's worst enemy or nothing, which would you choose? We are God's middle children, according to Tyler Durden, with no special place in history and no special attention. Unless we get God's attention, we have no hope for damnation or redemption. Which is worse, hell or nothing? Only if we're caught and punished can we be saved. Burn the Louvre, says the mechanic. Wipe your ass with the Mona Lisa. This way, at least God would know our names.
Yeah.
It's a good synopsis and of the kind of philosophy here of Project Mayhem.
And it ties into his own relationship with his father, who like would just split and start new franchises, as he called.
Every
right?
6 years or whatever he said. Which is a great...
consumerist
idea, which is a funny way to put it. It's good. It's a good... and, you know, the magazines around the house are the most mundane. It's Reader's Digest, right? It's very milquetoast, middle American. And again, who are we dealing with? Mechanics and waiters and, you know, actuaries, people, secretaries. Interesting.
What do you make of the ending then where he tries to kill himself and can't or doesn't as far as the value of life or... the will to live or, I don't know.
Well, I mean, in terms of satire, it's... fantastic, right? It's a crowded scene. He's in a giant phallus, and everyone who's been in the entire book so far shows up at once. Mm-hmm. Marla with the herd of hurt people, and upstairs is Project Mayhem, and here's our narrator talking to our narrator with a gun in his own mouth trying to kill the other guy. Before he talks to God. It turns into, like, a perfect satiric ending. Mm-hmm. But the whole world literally is about to fall apart and the book is collapsing in on himself. And he's talking to the person he wants to talk to, which is God, who in the end is kind of indifferent on the whole matter.
Yeah.
It's at least that's how I interpret it. It's in some ways it's the only way it could end. The fact that they do a Sunset Boulevard and it starts with, this is the story of how I die, makes, to me, sets it up as more satiric. But I don't know. What about you, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, you know that you're coming back to that moment, right?
Right.
So you know kind of the direction that this is kind of steering its way towards. And I think that, I don't know, I didn't read it quite as pessimistically. And maybe that's because I kind of took the narrator at his word in wanting to destroy the Tyler personality. And maybe that's wrong of me to put that kind of schism in between the narrator and Tyler Durden. But I took it to be the destruction of that part of himself, almost like the ridding of that cancerous aspect of himself to allow for the rest of him to be able to quite literally here kind of resurrect and to rise above after that encounter with God and after the death to be able to kind of allow for the narrator to be able to survive along afterwards, ridding himself of Tyler Durden. Now, the pessimistic in the encounter with God leads me to believe that he's still going to be kind of caught up in it after the end of the story.
Right.
And I haven't read the graphic novel versions of Fight Club 2 and Fight Club 3 that I know are out there, but I'm left kind of pessimistic, I guess you could say, more pessimistic than my reading, as to whether our narrator is going to actually be able to rid himself of that quote disease.
Right.
That
what is it in Greek? What is it? Thanatos, the death wish, the urge for death. So Tyler represents that, right? That's part of what makes you human. If you want to think about that, is that sort of inner battle or divinity or that sort of what is the destructive deity Kali in Indian mythology. But just that idea, that's part of what makes you human. You can't destroy that. Yeah. I don't know if you want to read it that way or not.
Well, certainly he doesn't destroy it, right? Because at the end of the
story, that's what everyone wants. Like when he wakes up,
exactly. Like, and we get all of the other characters, the employees that are there, and that's how the story ends too. Is yeah. that like can't wait to get you back out there. It's something along those lines that the story quite literally comes to an end with.
That implicit, contradiction.
Yeah,
that makes us human. Maybe I don't know.
Well, and I will, because we've been so good so far, I'm going to break my own rule and just mention the end of the movie, which is completely different, and ask if it makes more sense here. So at the end of the movie, Marla shows up, and he does shoot himself through the cheek, which is where we get the hole that we've been talking about so far, the hole in his cheek. Tyler goes away, and all we have back is the narrator. And he says, Marla, you've met me at a very interesting time in my life. And out the window, the other buildings still collapse. The explosions go really? Off. And we're in generic gray David Fincher city. But out the windows they're staring out of, all the other bombs go off and go down. So only he is protected. And we have no scene with God. The movie just ends with, you've met me at a very interesting time in my life.
And then destruction.
Yeah. Which, again, coming out in 99, it's very weird to watch a bunch of buildings go down. Now, again, take our class, but we've already had Oklahoma City. We've had the first bombing on the World Trade Center. We're not unused to bombs falling down or being at least blown up. But this is, of course, very specific. And in this context, Project Mayhem does look like a lot of these terrorist groups.
Yeah.
So the fact that he doesn't meet God and they're like, don't worry, buddy, you'll be back out there soon.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just different. Do you think he needs to meet God for this book to work? Or God, the psychologist that he's the poor psych that he's trying to talk to.
Yeah. No, I don't. I don't think that it does. I think that it reminds me of at the end of To Build a Fire, when we get the kind of the struggling narrator, or not narrator, but the struggling main character in that story who like meets the old man. I think it's from Sulphur Creek.
Right.
And you get kind of this like this otherworldly figure and character that helps to kind of tie off with a nice-ish little bow some of the or otherwise would tie off with a nice little bow some of the ideology behind what went into the story. But for the fact that the narrator is so... He doesn't seem to have much of a conversion, right? He goes right back, he falls right back onto the fact that there isn't any value to human life. And maybe if he were to get up to the golden or to the pearly gates and were to say that, like, I've had a change of ways, I now understand what you're saying, God, like, people do in fact have value. Look at Big Bob, but that's not the way that our narrator works, and that's not the way that the story works. So in a way, Nick, I think it actually kind of complicates some of the ending of the story, and thus makes me a little bit less sure what our narrator's opinion is when these hospital employees are saying, can't wait to get you back out there, Tyler.
Yeah.
That encounter with God almost makes me think that, well, he's pretty apt to get back out there.
Right.
Well, and I mean, let's like just put it in a more modern context in some ways, right? Like, Project Mayhem is this kind of proto-fascist, like patriarchal organization with a figurehead on top. Everyone's dressed the same, and they bring out chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens when the objective goes wrong? They go into hiding. They don't change who they are. They're still everywhere, waiting for the next big plot.
Signal, yeah. Right.
Yeah, and it's just, again, it's eerily prescient right now.
Oh,
and
very much so.
You know, and... You know, I won't say that this is just a critique on toxic masculinity. It's also a critique of the left saying, you can't be soft on this.
Mm.
You need to be able to stand up or this kind of thing could happen, right? Because there's a lot of people who could have intervened and fixed Tyler Durden or prevented Tyler Durden. But the doctor's just like, oh, just take some valerian root and relax, right? Open your chakras. Like, they're not making people better either. And I think that's the argument of the book as well. You know, it's as though he set out to make a book to piss everyone off. But at the same time, I think he has something to say. It's interesting.
Yeah.
You know? So, you know, when you're starting your militia, think of the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, what brings people together but that sense of shared purpose? And here it's destruction, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's fighting people who don't have that purpose, right? When they're caught for, he leaves a note in that woman's like bathroom that says, I peed in one of your perfumes, and she smashes it. And he goes, well, that was pretty cool. Like, it worked. He goes, look, getting fired is the best thing that can happen to us because it will free us and we'll move on. Because mm-hmm. he cares about no one else other than Tyler. But that's the philosophy. You are stuck because the system makes you stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Nonsense. It's interesting, but it's, you know, being intelligent, being mature, growing up, is realizing that Tyler's full of crap, I guess. But he is intriguing, and that's why this book, I think, matters. Yeah. Any final thoughts, gentlemen?
Would you teach it? Would you teach it here, Mike?
Oh, well, those are two different questions.
Sure.
I...
Or does it fit in our curriculum somewhere?
I know we were saying earlier, I think that there is... narratively, there are some similarities between Gatsby and Fight Club. And I know we were talking about the quote that Chuck Palahniuk himself had come up with. Mike, you were saying that you didn't buy it. The kind of this retelling of the story of the Great Gatsby with our three characters of Marla and Tyler and our narrator being so similar to the three main characters that are caught up in Gatsby, and you have this emblematic main character hero in Gatsby. You have this emblematic main character hero in Tyler. Both of them end up dying at the end of the story. And so there are some similarities that go into that, but I...
Tyler doesn't die, though. Right?
Well, or does he? Does he at the end of the story? I guess if you take on the thought that the narrator rids himself of that, because that's his intention.
True, I get it.
When he pulls the trigger. But still, nevertheless, I think that there's, I don't know, it's contemporary, it's countercultural, I guess you could say, thematically, certainly. So it could kind of fit into the American Lit curriculum towards the end of the term and in looking at kind of some very edgy texts. I don't know if I would, and that's no statement against Marist, but I don't know if I would want to teach it necessarily. Mm-hmm. I think for me it kind of like exists in this strange, edgy, cool, gritty story that I can read and I can get in and I can get out and I can appreciate it for the ideology that's behind it. But I wonder if it loses some of its magic and it loses some of its luster to kind of like dive into it the way that admittedly I had done the first time that I read through it.
How about you?
I think it'd be an interesting book circle book. I think the kids would have to choose it to get it. Like, I mean, just thinking of some students we have, and not to name names for kids who aren't here on the podcast, but, you know, this is a very masculine book. I think, you know, assigning it to some of our female students, A, they'd hate it, but B, like, I just don't think they'd get the same thing out of it. Like, right. I think there is something here that tells you that it's right to challenge things if you realize things are going wrong. Like, the fact that he loses all characteristics about himself to a nameless, like, godhead is the danger of the book. It's what you're warning against. You should be loud. You should be willing to step up and not be afraid to offend the people that are in charge if you think something wrong is going on. And that's drilled out of these people, and bad things happen because of it.
Yeah, I think, for the wrong group of kids, it could be an absolutely horrific book. Like, some immature boys, for example, like, would get the wrong messages from this, perhaps. Or
I think just read on a
superficial level. And, it, you know, rightly so, probably. Yeah. If you just leave them on their own to this. So, book circle for the right group of kids, I think, could be deepening. But I mean, having my first encounter with this and then hearing you guys talk, like, I need to talk through this and figure it out and sort of, because I had no familiarity with it. So, there's a lot there for sure, but I don't know if I would teach it either.
Yeah, I don't know. I just, in the latter part of the 20th and the early 21st century, literature, I don't want to say it's gotten stagnant. It's just a lot of the good stories ended up directly on TV or movies.
Yeah.
And this is something that took a lot of risks. We were talking before about Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, which is a previous episode and one we used to teach. We might not teach next year. And one of the things about it is experimental fiction is interesting and kids don't read a lot of it. This is experimental fiction. Oh, yeah. And it's just, I think there is something about, you know, stretching, you know, that your brain needs to do, and this book does that.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for listening. I think we've wrapped up Fight Club, and I appreciate you listening.
One last thing, though, I was actually just thinking, and then I'll use this as a segue into one last thing to talk about. But on my professional account, again, it's michael.c.carroll. If you haven't been following along, feel free to go on there for all things required reading. I do make a post for kind of what it is that we're reading here on the podcast. It's also kind of a place that you can go to follow me along in my publishing journey. One thing that I've been doing is I have a series on there called Beowulf Was First, where I look at a lot of the similarities and some of the inspirations in some other movies and texts and TV shows and stuff like that that find in some way, at least I make the argument for, some comparisons and allusions that are made to the Anglo-Saxon epic poem. And I can't help but now place Beowulf in this realm of masculinity of these three separate fight clubs with only two people to a fight between Beowulf and Grendel, and the masculinity that's there.
Nice.
Grendel, and then Grendel's mother, and then Grendel and the dragon, or I'm sorry, Beowulf and Grendel's mother, and then Beowulf and the dragon. So I think that there might be a post that I might write about Beowulf in the first ever Fight Club. But still, that's neither here nor there. What I wanted to do was, I know that earlier on in the season, I had talked a little bit about kind of my publishing journey for where I'm at with some of the texts that I've written, and wanted to kind of keep people updated with that. I as a writer, it's still a challenge for me to kind of talk about my own writing, and I get self-conscious in a way, and I feel great talking about other people's works of literature, but talking about my own can be a little bit I get a little bit withdrawn when I do that for whatever reason. But I did want to let people know that I had about 8 months ago, I had a manuscript request for Beyond the Fall of Kings, which is the novel that I wrote, that is kind of the historical fiction behind the story of Beowulf. So that's being considered right now. And so you guys can, again, follow along with the Instagram account for more information about that. I've also had a short story that I wrote that is in a... it's going to be scheduled to come out in a literary magazine based through the Fantasy and Science Fiction Writers Alliance, which is that collection is called Verses, and the literary magazine is going to be publishing A Wrong Cruelly Done, which is a short story that I wrote that's going to be coming out in December. So for more information on all of these things, you can follow along with the Instagram account, the professional page that I have. It's, again, michael.c.carroll for a little bit more with that. And I look forward to being able to have some sort of an update at the start of the next season. I know that this is kind of the last of our regularly scheduled podcasts that we'll have for season three of Required Reading, but getting into season four, which I can't wait to schedule with you guys and talk about what it is that might be around the corner, I'll have another update for how publishing and things are going.
That's awesome. That congrats on your success. Yeah, there.
You.
Yeah,
appreciate it.
Well done. Mike, you got anything to plug?
No, I have nothing to plug. Summer is here.
Yeah, we're this is literally the last day of stuff, so we're all a little stir crazy.
Yeah.
You know, I'm working on something, but I have nothing yet of value to share. So hopefully by this fall I'll have something to plug. But in the meantime, as Mike alluded to, we'll be trying to release something a month during the summer, and then start with a new season in the fall, or at least fall as far as the school year is concerned. But thanks for doing everything you do. Thanks for listening. Thanks for sharing. And we appreciate the fact that you're still listening, which is why we still do this. And I saw Mike is going to have a guest spot coming up on another podcast, and we'll be around. So look for us and keep following the socials. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Yep.
Required Reading is a product of Maris Podcasting and Dude Letter Podcasting. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman and co-hosted by Mike Burns and Mike Carroll. It is edited and produced by Nick Hoffman. The theme is Sands by Davis Burns. The opinions expressed are opinions of the hosts and the guests, but not of Marist School. All rights reserved. Thanks!